are listening to 2012 Journey to Evolution, where the evolution of mind and heart meets spirit. Today, we are welcoming you to the fourth installment of our Prophets Conference series. This year's Prophet Conference series is taking place in Vancouver from July 23rd to the 27th, and the theme is 2012 Tipping Point. We've had many great minds so far in our previous installments speaking about their perspectives, from Mayan prophecies to Hopi prophecies, and today we have one of a cosmological perspective. And, you know, there aren't many who can argue the fact that we as a human family are experiencing tremendous changes. Even Earth herself, we as individuals changing and evolving within the microcosm, directly connected to the macrocosm's expression of change and evolution. My guest today has been quoted as saying, "Today we find ourselves wandering disconsolately between two worlds, one dying and the other struggling to be born. On the one hand, the spiritual and intellectual certainties of the past no longer command our allegiance. On the other hand, the promises of a more integral worldview, a cosmology of tomorrow, one based on a deeper relationship with nature and with the larger cosmos, require of us a leap of faith few are as yet willing to take." I'm so honored to introduce Richard Tarnas, my guest today. Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Richard is a graduate of Harvard University and the Saybrook Institute. He was for 10 years the director of programs at the Esalen Institute. He's the founder of the graduate program in philosophy, cosmology, and consciousness at the California Institute of Integral Studies and an adjunct faculty member of the Pacifica Graduate Institute. My goodness, what an impressive biography you have. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Well, thanks a lot. It's not that impressive to me. It's just me. I mean, it's just it's my own life. But everybody's biography is impressive if you, I think, go deep enough.
Well, he has humility to add to that, which makes it even more profound. I wanted to just get straight to my question and just jump right in with you. There are many perspectives that attempt to define this moment in history, as you have called it. You know, there's the divinatory and the prophetic perspective, which is the Mayan and the prophecies of the Hopi and all other indigenous peoples. And then there is the cosmological perspective. You know, I want to ask you, what are the differences between the two, and or are they just two different languages explaining the same thing?
Well, I think each perspective, each cultural tradition has its own wisdom tradition and its own special capacities to tune into the deeper realities of the cosmos and of history or of our time. And each culture and each epoch, each time era has, in a way, certain gifts, as well as certain blind spots, that are that characterize its vision. And I think one of the special characteristics of our time is the fact that there are so many perspectives and modes of knowledge, ways of knowing that are on the table, as it were, that are available to an audience such as yours or to you and me, than has ever been available before. It's an enormous multiplication of sources that we've got for entering into or apprehending the mystery of life. So that's the starting point. And so there can be multiple entrances into that mystery. It's not just, I think, that there is a single objective truth and then we're all approaching it from different ways. It's even more mysterious than that, because each approach to the truth, like, let's say, modern Western science, for example, would be one approach, or Christian mystical experience could be another, or shamanic experience using ayahuasca ritual in Peru or Brazil could be another. And each of those is not only a way of getting at a single truth from different perspectives. Different kinds of truths open up as a result of the different approaches. So in a way, the deeper reality of life is being co-created by each culture and by each person according to what kind of consciousness and what kind of method of knowing that is being brought to the unfolding reality. So in what I'm describing is a more participatory understanding of knowledge rather than the idea that there's a single objective truth that's being approached in different ways by all these subjective, imperfect approaches, each of which is just, you know, getting at different parts of the elephant. I think, a little more mysterious. We're actually creating the world and the universe and reality as we moment to moment engage with it and experience it unfolding inside us. Does that all make sense?
Absolutely, it does. And, you know, what I hear you saying and how I relate to it, based on my perspective, is that from a quantum physics point of view and understanding, or I'll say better, my understanding of it, in regard to there being unlimited versions of everything, and that how there is a little truth in every religion and every ideology, that depending upon, you know, like every perspective, some think the world is going to end in 2012. Some think that it's a dawning of a new age. And rather than saying one is right and one is wrong, I would say they're both true, and every version in between that might be true. And kind of going off what you just said and how I interpret it is based upon what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling and the consciousness that I'm choosing, I am creating which version my consciousness is going to experience.
Yeah, I think that's the overall point that you made. I totally agree with, namely that we are playing a crucial role in creating the future. I think I would put it a little bit differently on a couple of those points. For example, there's those people who think the world's going to absolutely come to an end in a cataclysm in 2012.
Right.
I believe there is a way in which a person's fears and anxieties can get projected onto the greater mystery and distort that mystery. So it's not just that every approach is valid in its own way. Error and projection and distortion really occur. Those distortions and projections can have their effect, but they don't necessarily have the effect of simply creating the reality where, let's say, certain people are convinced that the entire world will come to a cataclysmic end, will not necessarily happen to everybody in the world on that day, and therefore, in certain fundamental way, those people were wrong, or may prove to be wrong. So I'm trying to allow for us having a more I-thou relationship to the mystery of reality. It's not an I-it relationship where people project onto this blank screen and then create whatever reality they projected. It's more mysterious. There's more of a relationship. There's more of a dialogue going on between each of us and our cultures with the larger mystery of being. That's a slight difference. But let's go back to your original question, which is about the difference between, let's say, Mayan prophecies about something happening in 2012, or Hopi And these more either prophetic or divinatory approaches to the ending of, or to a given phenomenon, such as 2012, versus, and then you mentioned the word cosmological. Now, the word, I think what you're referring to there in particular is, one of my books is called Cosmos and Psyche. And in Cosmos and Psyche, I set out, basically hundreds and hundreds of, I look at history and I note the consistent patterning of events, the archetypal patterns of human history and human experience seem to correlate with astonishing consistency with the movements of the planets, particularly the outer planets, in a way that astrologers, particularly the Western astrological tradition that has so studied the outer planets and where we have such good both historical records but also records of the planetary positions. And there's also a consensus about what those planets, what their archetypal meanings are. And it's quite astonishing to look at, let's say, how the 1960s coincided with the only conjunction in the 20th century of two planets or celestial bodies, Uranus and Pluto, which every time they come into conjunction or opposition, which is just, once or twice a century, for a good 10 or 12 years, there's a period of tremendous impulse for radical change, for revolutionary impulses that can sweep across the society or in the world, such as happened, the French Revolution was another one such epoch when those same two planets came into alignment. And or by contrast, you can see something like the Saturn-Pluto cycle and how it coincided with the beginnings of both world wars or 9/11 in quite like clockwork way. Each time they come into hard aspect, like the Vietnam War started in one case, or the rise of Hitler and Stalin and fascism and so forth, sort of totalitarianism in another one and so forth, and the Iraq War and 9/11 was the last one we had. So these archetypal patterns in history are quite decisive. I mean, everybody who's sufficiently studied the evidence has come away with the sense that there is something going on here that can't be explained by conventional modern science. I'm a professor of cultural history and philosophy, and was skeptical of astrological claims. But once one does, I've now studied for 30 years very carefully the evidence, and it's quite clear that there is a correlation there that's astonishingly powerful, consistent, and rich. So,
and scientific, I would say.
Yeah, in the best sense. And so, what the distinction I would make between that approach of, we call it archetypal astrology. There's a group of about 80 scholars here, colleagues, professors, researchers, graduate students who are here in the Bay Area who are part of this archetypal research collective who've been doing these studies. And that particular approach, which we call archetypal astrology, and part of a larger perspective or discipline called archetypal cosmology, that can be distinguished from, let's say, a more prophetic or divinatory approach, such as the Mayans or the Hopi would be using. Not that one is superior to the other. It's each one has its own capacity to intuit or register a deeper truth. But the virtue of the archetypal astrological perspective is that we can look at this time that we're in right now, 2010, 2010, 2011, 2012, and say we can look at where the planets are now. There's a very powerful configuration in the planets. It's quite rare. It's called the Saturn Pluto, Uranus, T-square. It's where two of the planets are in opposition, 180 degrees. And then there's a third planet. The third of them is in a tight square, 90 degrees to the other two. The last time we had that was between 1929 and 1933, when there was, again, worldwide economic collapse, major social, political turmoil, tremendous impulse for radical change, and so forth. And there's other major transits that are going on as well right now, which we might allude to later. But my main point is, when we look at the evidence for what's going on right now, and it very much fits the what's happening right now, but the planetary configurations are so consistent in looking back in history, there are parallels to what is happening now, so that we have an empirical database, as it were, to get a sense for, well, what are the archetypal energies at work? What's the weather like, as it were, cosmically speaking, that we're going out into this, you know, onto the sea with in our boat, or are we going surfing with? And that, knowing that archetypal weather patterning, gives us greater capacity to intelligently navigate these years. And the difference between that and, let's say, a prophetic view is that the prophetic, like when another perspective says, this is what's going to happen in 2012, we can't look back 26,000 years earlier and say, oh yeah, look at what happened 26,000 years ago, and that's what we can expect here, or that type of thing, because we've got a whole sequence of periods when the same cosmic reality was happening, and therefore we can make a judgment. It's more coming from, as it were, an inspired divination, a prophecy from some deep place, but it's not based on that kind of accumulation of evidence that, in a way, the Western modern mind has so based its understanding of reality on. And so the archetypal astrological view, in a sense, combines the two, because it combines evidence and historical data and planetary positions with what James Hillman calls an archetypal eye, that is, the capacity to see the symbolic patterning of events and human experience. Hope that all makes sense.
It does. I'm following you. You began to answer my next question, actually. It had to do with, you know, 26,000 years ago. What was the alignment then, and how is it the same as we're, you know, reaching into this new dawn, this new era? Is the planetary alignment so close, if not exact, or where does it differ, if any?
Okay, well, this is something that I think your other interviewees that you've had in recent weeks, or will have in the coming weeks prior to this 2012 conference in Vancouver, these other interviewees who are, like John Major Jenkins, for example, who is expert in the Mayan literature, can answer that with greater authority. But my understanding is that it has something to do with the alignment of the winter solstice with the galactic center, which is something that happens not. I mean, generally, it can't be seen as, at least technically in an astronomical sense, can't be seen as happening on a specific day, nor even on a specific year, but within a window. And it takes, you know, decades to go across, you know, a single degree. So there's a bit of what we might call an orb of influence here that one's working with that makes any judgments more approximate. But that is, you know, very roughly speaking, the great year, the Platonic year of approximately 26,000 years how long it takes for the precession of the equinoxes to move the winter solstice all the way around the entire zodiac. So we don't know what was happening 26,000 years ago. We don't have the historical data. There's nothing like, you know, I can tell you right off the top of my head 10 extraordinary events that happened, say, 100 years ago or 500 years ago, you know, in, let's say, you know, the, in the early 1500s when Michelangelo was finishing the Sistine Chapel. In the same months that he finished that, Copernicus hypothesized the heliocentric universe and started the scientific revolution, and Martin Luther started giving his sermons that basically reflected the beginnings of the Protestant Reformation, and the first Europeans saw the Pacific Ocean as they crossed the Isthmus of Panama, and so forth. This convergence of things that all happened in the early 1500s, in this case 1513, 1512, that period there, we have such good historical data, I can point to that. But who can say that about 26,000 years ago? Nobody I know, unless they're... you know, Rudolf Steiner maybe reading the Akashic Record, but even he could be a little bit vague on dates.
Right. You know, I think that there's so many perspectives, and basically all I've ever been able to do is just go with that gut, go with, you know, whatever feels true, whatever feels... what resonates with myself and my own journey. And I think there's, you know, billions of different truths. Many people that are on the planet right now, they all have a slightly different perspective. And it's really hard to say what is accurate and what's not. I mean, wouldn't you say, isn't it all different perspective?
Well, I mean, in a way, that's the postmodern view, is that it's all relative. Everybody's got their different perspective. Nobody's in control of a God's eye view that can say, this is right, and all the rest of you are wrong. On the other hand, we do have a sense that some people are more wrong than others, and that shows up in very testable ways, like two people say, you know, we're not standing at a cliff, and when I make this next step, watch, I'm not going to fall. Well, if one person falls and the other person doesn't, we can say that one of those people was a little more wrong than the other.
Right, right. And obviously, the point in time in our history when everyone thought that everything revolved around the Earth and not the Sun. Clearly, examples like that, we can apply that to.
Yeah, although actually there are philosophers, scientists who will make the case that there is a way in which the Earth is still, and but I agree with your point. That was more of an intellectual exercise that people have made, that there is, at one level, one can basically make all the measurements. And from a relativistic point of view, there's an equivalence between the geocentric and the heliocentric perspective. But bottom line, we have a consensus that that's not so.
Well, I mean, it was an outrageous thought back in that day. And based on the few things that I read, just in regard to, there were very few scientists that, you know, had to keep that to themselves, just the thought of being outside of the box, you know. And looking back in that time, I'll just quote you when you say, the early scientific revolutionaries perceived their breakthroughs as divine illuminations, spiritual awakenings to the true structural grandeur and intellectual beauty of the cosmic order. Now, how do you compare that to today's scientific revolutionaries? You know, how would you describe the illuminations of their thoughts today, and how it's relevant to this moment in this new birthing of our new era?
Well, I think often people who are involved in any form of inquiry and discovery have the sense that at the moment of discovery, that something is being illuminated in their minds in a way that, as if they're being touched by grace. There's a sense of breakthrough, even a sense of numinosity. And that feeling can come with greater or lesser force. It's quite clear that for the Copernican revolutionaries, perhaps Kepler above all, Newton too, but Kepler was probably the one who I think had the greatest sense of a mystical awakening, as it was basically Kepler who achieved the Copernican revolution. He did it mathematically, and in the same months that Galileo turned the telescope to the heavens and gave a kind of an empirical support. But really, the Copernican revolution was pulled off by Kepler in his mathematical solution of the problem of the planets, showing that they're moving in ellipses. Just to give you and your listeners a sense of the spiritual power of that moment when Kepler's basically experiencing his breakthrough as a spiritual revelation that's coming in a way straight from God. Let me read this beautiful passage from Kepler. This is at the moment that he's discovered the third of the three laws of planetary motion, which completed the early mathematical foundation of the heliocentric theory or the Copernican revolution. And listen to this powerful solar imagery, by the way, how present the sun and the solar impulse is at work. The sun representing, in a way, the divine God's light that illuminates the world, the solar logos, Christ as the solar logos, Prometheus stealing the solar fire from the heavens and liberating humankind. All of this is packed into this quotation symbolically as Kepler declares his feelings at the moment of having made this discovery. Now, since the dawn 18 months ago, since the broad daylight 3 months ago, and since a few days ago when the full sun illuminated my wonderful speculations, nothing holds me back. I yield freely to the sacred frenzy. I dare frankly to confess that I have stolen the golden vessels of the Egyptians to build a tabernacle for my God far from the bounds of Egypt. If you pardon me, I shall rejoice. If you reproach me, I shall endure. The die is cast, and I am writing the book, to be read either now or by posterity. It matters not. It can wait a century for a reader, as God himself has waited 6,000 years for a witness. Now that's Kepler, and when you basically take into account that at that moment he's realizing that for the first time in all of history, the true cosmic order, the perfection of the mathematical universe, the mathematical elegance of the way the planets are moving around the sun has been revealed to him. And up until that point, and he saw Copernicus as the great center. You know, he said Copernicus is at the high altar, and I'm sort of serving at that same altar. He was very humble about it in certain ways. But if you take into account the fact that there was this feeling that the divine cosmic order was now being revealed to the human mind for the first time after the fall from grace, as it were, when no one had access to what this order was. It was a true divine epiphany. Now, scientists today also have those kinds of feelings, not necessarily at that level, but you know, I think the drive that many scientists have to discover is partly they're looking for that feeling of being graced by the universe with the deeper truth of the universe revealing itself to them. And so then they feel like they've been in a way, divinely blessed when that happens, and there's a great euphoric uplift, and there's numinous feelings looming behind the quest for scientific discovery in every era, even in an atheistic community of learning.
You know, it's ironic. That is the very passage that I just read today. That's the one that you chose to read. And what I got, I mean, all of what you said absolutely is profound. And additionally, I would say, what I got from his statement, if you pardon me, I will rejoice. If you, I don't know if you use the word rebuke me or somewhere to that effect, it matters not. You know, in my experience, whenever I've had an illuminating divine experience, that there is no question in my being that I have touched some part of God, it makes no difference if anyone believes me. It makes no difference what they have to say about it. There is a rooted knowingness that nothing outside of me can reject it. You know, it's that profound. So thinking of scientists, even when they have those type of moments that, you know, I'm just thinking of these men, even back in those times when the concepts that were held so strictly of the time, and then to broaden themselves so outside of the box because of the profundity of being touched by something they know is God itself, however you want to, you know, explain that or define that, that divinity that is greater than all of us, but yet a part of all of us. I think it's beautiful. On that note, we're going to take a little break, and we will be back momentarily with Richard Tarnas. Richard, we'll be back in a second.
Place you supposed to be, and it's plain to see.
we're back. 2012 Journey to Evolution, and we have Richard Tarnas. We wanted to just wrap up the subject of, I asked Richard how he would describe the illumination of the scientific revolutionary and how it's relevant to where we're at. Can you just follow up on that?
Yes. I hope that I'm you're able to hear me okay. Just right now when you were, I heard you cutting out as you were talking. Let's see. Can you hear me okay? Okay, good.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now hear you.
Let me just repeat that just in case you shared that with our listeners. If they heard me going in and out, I'll repeat the question.
All right.
I just said that we were wrapping up the content of how you would describe the illuminations of today's scientific revolutionaries. Like, what are today's scientists posed with in terms of challenging them to think outside of the box? Is it quantum theory?
Yeah.
Is it, you know, where are we at and where are we going with what is today's view?
Well, there's so many different scientific communities, and so to generalize is always a little risky, but let me take a couple risks and point out some larger patterns. First of all, there's something called new paradigm science, which is very connected, for example, to the developments in quantum physics, but it's also happening in things like chemistry with the work of Ilya Prigogine, or in physics, certainly people like David Bohm. You could see it in the area of biology with Rupert Sheldrake, and you have all these different people who are pushing the scientific perspective to new horizons within the established disciplines of, you know, physics and chemistry and biology, Barbara McClintock and so forth, people working within the area of animal behavior, getting new insights into the depth of interiority that exists in our animal brothers and sisters in a way that opens up a greater sense of kinship rather than human beings being somehow radically different from the rest of the animal kingdom, that we somehow can look upon them as harvestable commodities. So in many scientific disciplines, there are people who are really pushing the boundaries, transforming the paradigms, opening us up to a more holistic, participatory, spiritually informed perspective. Somebody who's summarized a lot of this work, of course, Fritjof Capra is well known in this area from the time of the Tao of Physics on, and his book called The Turning Point. Rupert Sheldrake does a lot of summarizing too, but most recently a European scholar by the name of Irvin Laszlo has done some excellent books that summarize many of these developments. Okay, so that's within the existing sciences. Then you have within the major orthodox sciences in the area of cosmology and astronomy, the whole opening up of the deep cosmos in time and space being done partly through the Hubble telescope and telescopic discoveries, but also through theories, whether it's string theory or theories about the expanding universe, the evolving universe. And there's a lot of thinking outside the box there. Most of that thinking outside the box is still done in a pretty secularized, unspiritual perspective. But there are great thinkers within that area in the tradition of Teilhard de Chardin who are moving that discourse further. I think of Brian Swim, my colleague who I teach with here at California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, and Brian Swim's work with Thomas Berry has really done a lot of great work in that area. Then there's the great psychologist, which is another kind of science, Stanislav Grof, and the work in transpersonal psychology, deeply expanding our understanding of the human psyche until we really can now see that the depths of the unconscious, the depths of the human psyche, are really coextensive with the soul of the cosmos, with the anima mundi, and that everything, each one of us, ultimately has access to everything in the deep, everything that's ever happened in the universe is in some sense accessible to us because of this embeddedness that each of us has in the, we are the cosmos. It's not that we're in the cosmos or on the earth. We are the earth. We are the cosmos in human form as, you know, Richard Tarnas or as Tambourine, as Rupert Sheldrake or whoever, as Jane Austen. Each of us is the universe Jane Austening or Shakespearean or Mick Jaggering, as it were.
Well, you know, which also transcends into what you were saying a moment ago in regard to the animal kingdom. When we can see all forms of life as part of us, that we, the only difference is the garment that we're choosing to wear. You know, as you, as Richard, me, as Tambourine, you know, the horse as the horse, the spider as the spider, and the bee as the bee. And once we can see that connectedness, and then, of course, out to the macrocosm of the cosmos and the stars and the planets, I mean, you know, that's a spiritual experience when you get into the profundity of what that really means.
I completely agree. And in a way, that was one of the points that Fritjof Capra was making with the Tao of Physics, is that every science like physics or psychology or botany, study of mushrooms, whatever it is, can be a pathway or a Tao, a way to the heart of the divine mystery. So can being a mother, so can being a lover, so can working with ants. Every single pathway has a potential divine meaning and transformative power.
Well, let me tell you, the most profound lessons that I've ever learned have been from nature and observing nature. I wanted to, while we still have enough time, to get your perspective on how you see the masculine and feminine balancing out in this new era, and what are the roles of both in regard to that?
Great question, and I think it really is fundamental. I think the masculine-feminine polarity and dialectic is one of the most crucial of our time, and it's playing out on a number of levels. You have, for example, if you look at the understanding of reality that has shaped Western civilization and the modern mindset, it was pretty much determined by men in a patrilineal tradition from, you know, Plato and Aristotle to Descartes, right up to Newton and Einstein and Freud and so forth. And that tradition, that patrilineal perspective combined with the, you know, patriarchal power structures has had an enormous effect on how human beings relate to their embeddedness in nature, the relationship to sexuality, to relationship itself, to our emotions, and so forth. And there's an enormous rebalancing and transformation happening. Now, I'd like to make a distinction between the masculine-feminine polarity and what we might call the solar-lunar polarity, because in a way there's, you know, the solar principle, which has a focus on this one powerful bright light that has one, when it shines, there's just one light, there's one truth in the sky, there's one powerful reality, compared to the lunar, which allows us to see the larger whole of the night sky, and many lights are there, and night, light, and dark are more mysteriously interconnected and so forth. And the lunar, which seems to have a deep relationship to the Great Mother Goddess and to the larger whole and matrix of being, compared to the solar heroic logos of the sun symbol. And there's been a major connection between the masculine and the solar in patriarchy, and the lunar and the feminine. But what we're coming to see more and more is that there's also a solar feminine as well as a lunar feminine, like a woman who is a shining individual, assertive, self-determining, independent. That's the solar feminine. The lunar feminine is more the woman who's the mother, relational, in touch with the emotional and intuitive whole. And conversely, there's also not only a solar masculine, which is the patriarchal standard, but there's also a lunar masculine, like the man who tenderly holds his child, or who's very relationally sensitive with his beloved, or who is in touch with his emotions, or intuitively apprehending the whole in a sensitive way. All those things are the lunar masculine. And I think our time is a time when the whole solar-lunar polarity is needing to come into balance, into a not only a balance, but into a sacred marriage. It's playing itself out in male-female relationships, but it's also playing itself out in the human being's relationship to nature, civilization's relationship to nature, and really the human being's relationship to the entire cosmos. And this movement into a more I-thou solar-lunar conjunctio, to use the Latin and Jungian term, a conjunction of the opposites, and movement into a sacred marriage involves a lot of struggle, a lot of dying to old identities and structures, but will also permit the possibility of, I think, a beautiful new whole, a new birth, a new dawn to emerge. And that, I think, is really the critical challenge of our time.
I could not agree with you more in regard to that. Every example that you gave of relationship, man with woman, with the earth, with the cosmos, with everything, and I heard just in my head as you were saying that, I heard, and relationship to self. Because even personally, I've experienced, just in this last period of time, the balancing within my own self of masculine and feminine, and the key of really coming into balance, accepting women, and integrating the feminine and masculine within ourselves, men integrating the feminine and masculine within themselves, and within that, when we relate to each other, we could really have a relatedness, not necessarily the old archetype of the relationship that comes with so much baggage, but actually just relating to each other and respecting and honoring both aspects of the solar, of the lunar, and becoming one beautiful, powerful union. I think it's beautiful and brilliant. You said it beautifully.
Well, thanks, and so did you. And I think that's that is where the bottom line is, it's happening interiorly to each of us at the same time as it's being required outside in all of our relationships and even on a macro level of human civilization to the earth. And I think we could generalize that in many ways women's challenge is to own their solar autonomy, become their own sun, as S-U-N, not projected onto the men in their lives, but have their own solar individual autonomy at the same time as sustaining their lunar relational and intuitive and emotional sensitivity to the whole. And if they can keep those two not only in balance, but actually working together at the same time that men do the same task of disidentifying with the just being, the lone cowboy solar hero and being so repressive of relationships and their emotions and so forth, and come into a be less of a conquistador and more of a whole human being, and have the solar and lunar in balance, just as we all have in our astrological charts. We've all got the sun and moon in our charts. It's right there. We've got the whole inside us, and our task is to actualize the whole and bring them into a dynamic, fruitful relationship.
I really think that's where we're heading. This new era, I believe that it will just be a natural inclination. And I, for one, look forward to that.
Amen.
Amen, brother. Well, we have a couple minutes left, and I want to give you the opportunity to share with our listeners where you're going to be, what you're up to, and let them know anything you'd like to share with them.
Well, let's see. If people would like to hear or see more, get more encounter with some of the ideas that we've been discussing here, I basically have two books. One's we were talking about Cosmos and Psyche. Intimations of a New Worldview is a subtitle, but Cosmos and Psyche, it's published in paperback now by Viking Penguin Publishing. And then there's the book that's used in many universities as a history of Western thought and spirit. That's called The Passion of the Western Mind. And Passion of the Western Mind is also published in paperback by Ballantine. These are both quite inexpensive, so they're not too big of a pull on the pocketbook. And then if you want to just go online, I have a website called cosmosandpsyche.com. It's cosmosandpsyche.com. And also, for those of you who are really deeply into the archetypal astrological perspective and want to, we have a new journal that's currently free online, the first issue. It's called Archai, Journal of Archetypal Cosmology. It's a great journal. It's being edited by a whole group of people. It's spelled A-R-C-H-A-I. A-R-C-H-A-I, that's archaijournal.org. Other than that, let's see, for those of you who are in Canada, I'm going to be speaking at this Vancouver conference the weekend of, July? Yeah, you've probably been announcing it, but it's around the
July 23rd to the 27th.
Thank you. I think I'm on that Sunday. And then, generally, I do give lectures all around the world, but I'm based here in San Francisco Bay Area, and I founded a program here called it's a PhD and master's program at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and the program is called Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness, and I teach there with Brian Swim, Stan Groff, Sean Kelly, Robert McDermott, Elizabeth Allison, Joanna Macy. Some really great people, and it's a great program. So anyway, those of you who are inclined towards higher education and can live in the Bay Area, that might be something you'd be interested in.
Richard, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. It was a true pleasure of mine, and I look forward to seeing you in Canada. I'm going to be at the conference too.
Great. Well, I really enjoyed our interview. You do a great job, and I'll see you there.
Richard, thank you so much. And everyone, I want to remind you, the Prophets Conference has been very gracious. They are giving us two free tickets every show from now until the Prophets Conference at the end of July. So if you would like to go, please feel free to contact the station, and they will connect you to my email, and we'll get you there, and you'll be able to see Richard in person. Again, we thank Richard Tarnas for joining us and shedding some beautiful insights and wisdom, and we will see you next week at the same time, same bat channel. Good night.
in this matrix of illusion. So much pain and self-abuse. Forgotten who we are in this delusion. So we continue to play the charade. There's always someone that does it better.
Don't have to push and you surely don't have to fight.